No? Well, they'll make it. Stragglers. I like Mark. He always assumes it's one of yours. It's got to be. It's got to be one of mine. Now, your wife is back there. She's. Yeah. Okay. All right. You should have your Bibles open to the 44th Psalm, Psalm 44. We're looking at this psalm because it is actually quoted by our apostle, the Apostle Paul, in Romans chapter 8 and verse 36 as the godly remedy to the sufferings of the policy of evil when we begin living our lives as sons and the adversary starts to ply his tactics of trying to separate us from that love of Christ. And in doing so, the first thing that we encounter in his at his disposal is the issue of tribulations. And that's exactly what we're going to be experiencing sometime, someplace, somewhere, as we begin taking our godly wisdom out into this world in Romans 12 and verse 12, when we are to rejoice in hope and be patient in tribulation. So we're really now getting to the point where all this background work has gone is to the issue, the core issue of the hope doctrine that was love-based, love-convinced in us is based upon the remedy, the godly remedy that God expresses through the Apostle Paul that's found here in Psalm 44 and down in verse 22. For thy sake we are killed all the day long, we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. And you have to appreciate that in terms of what goes on in the first part of this psalm, because when the members of the remnant of Israel, you got to remember that out here, these guys are going to be operating now as sons themselves. Because now that Christ has provided the redemption that he did on Calvary's cross, and you have the new covenant being inaugurated there that has all the spiritual issues that make it so that sonship is now available to Israel, that remnant is going to be operating that way. However, with that said, they're going to have heard about and remember all that their fathers had told them about how God did his miraculous things with them to deliver them as a nation from all of the ills that they were facing out there with the Canaanites, at least at first. They didn't completely conquer the land because they actually, because of their own rebelliousness and sin, they actually began these courses of punishment taking place, and God began withdrawing his hand from them to the point where Ezekiel, for instance, actually sees what's going to happen in the Lord's, when the Lord Jesus Christ is here. By that time, God has left the temple. He then left the city of Jerusalem. And Ezekiel sees him in his chariots leaving the entire nation of Israel. So that by the time Jesus shows up on this earth and he goes into the temple, it's now the headquarters of Satan himself. That's what the temple had become during the day of Jesus Christ on this earth. It wasn't a nice place. That's one of the reasons he had to go and cleanse it. He had to throw some people out. And so this again is the kind of thinking in their minds, and then suddenly they're out here in the Lord's day of wrath and they're experiencing that wrath. And the nation is going through this, and you have this spirit on the one hand and the soul on the other hand of these remnant members, and the soul and the spirit's going at each other. And the soul is hurting and it wants relief, and it's asking the spirit to give it something to operate on. And if it doesn't, then there's all this turmoil going on in there. And I'm telling you, I've stayed away. If you want to get this, get it the first time we went through it. It's all on tape and been recorded. But I am describing this mildly. I'm putting this extremely mild. Because what can go on in your inner man when you're facing these kinds of things is crushing. It is crushing in the kind of turmoil that can take place in your inner man. When you're suffering things and you have no answers for why and you don't know what to do with it, it can crush you. And it can disappoint you, and it can discourage you, and it can do it can send you into depression, to the blackest, darkest areas of your mind and heart that you've ever gone. And if you don't think I'm right, you have not read some of the things that Paul himself experienced and where that would have taken him in his mind had it not been for the effectual working of God's Word to do things that we can use and talk about terms such as deliver. That's a perfectly acceptable term to talk about today in this dispensation of grace. God does deliver. Paul was delivered from those things, but not because his external circumstances were changed, but his internal circumstances were. And you've got to get it through your thick head and say, and I don't mean this, I mean this lovingly, that in God's economy, that is greater power than his external power. Problem is, people don't know what's valuable to God and which power is the most powerful. That's why when Paul talks about that kind of inner man power in like the book of Ephesians, he starts stacking power words on top of one another. That you might be strengthened by the might and the power. And he gets all these words and he starts stacking them in the inner man because he knows that's where God has vested his greatest powerful work of all. Well, anyway, I'm getting off track on all of that. These guys here and the remnant here of Israel, as they're experiencing these things, their confusion had come up before them. Notice, though, that the things that they say there, when they talk about there in verse 17, all this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten thee, neither have we dealt falsely with thy covenant. They really hadn't. That's true of those sons out there. They hadn't dealt falsely with his covenant. Their heart was not turned back. They haven't declined their steps from his way, even though they have been sore broken in the place of dragons. And as he says, look on down at verse 18. Our heart is not turned back, neither have our steps declined from thy way, though thou hast sore broken us in the place of dragons and covered us with the shadow of death. Very few people know, because they don't pay attention to the Bible, what God means by the shadow of death. The shadow of death, that's like in the 23rd Psalm. The shadow of death in the 23rd Psalm has nothing to do with the grave. But anyway, the shadow of death, they're going to experience that out there. If we have forgotten the name of God, verse 20 says, or stretched out our hands to a strange God, shall not God search this out? For he knoweth the secrets of the heart. Well, they have been covered with the shadow of all of this is what they're saying there is true. Those are all truisms. And then all they can do is come along and say, you know, what we're going through out here would make sense, God, if we had forgotten your name, if we had stretched out our hands to a strange God, we deserve to expect this. Or expect to deserve this. But wouldn't you search this out? Wouldn't you know the secrets of the heart? Wouldn't you convict us of that? What's going on here? We're confused. And they've got this inner man going at one another, and the confusion has come up. And then verse 22 is the statement they make. Listen, when they finally return to sober thinking. Now that should have made a light go on. I spent a lot of time dealing with that when we hit Romans 12. Let me put it this way. One of the marks of a son, and it's a difference between just a son, an intelligized, and I don't mean a son who's, God doesn't pump your IQ up. I mean you've been taught, you've been intelligized, you've got intelligent understanding. The difference between an intelligized son and the average Christian can be boiled down to the fact that the son thinks soberly. Now, you tell me, what does that mean? If you think with sober thinking, what is the main issue that makes that the dividing issue between the way a son thinks and just any old Christian thinks? We're not even going to talk about the way a non-Christian, the world thinks. When you think sober, not under the influence of this world, of the wisdom of this world. Many Christians today, most that goes on in church today, in many churches, is done based upon the wisdom of this world. The order of the service, the colors that are laid out, the calendar that's followed. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I can't help but say it. I just couldn't believe. A couple of years after I came here, the News and Observer printed this big article on the Baptist churches in Raleigh, and it had a Baptist preacher that had the Ash Wednesday, ashes on his forehead. Now, if it wasn't enough that they, I guess, didn't understand the difference between the Reformation and what it means to be a Protestant, these Baptists actually went to the Catholic Church to get their ashes. They wouldn't work just out of their fireplace. They had to go to the Catholic Church to get them. And they saw this as a good thing. We just had Fat Tuesday. Fat Tuesday was last Tuesday, is that right? Some people don't even know what Fat Tuesday is. Well, right after Fat Tuesday is where you go crazy. That's Mardi Gras. And you just gorge yourself in every possible way. You know why? Because what happens on the day after Fat Tuesday? Ash Wednesday, Lent starts. So now you're going to give up something for 40 days. Do you know that the Christians today who will go to church on Easter, they mark Easter based upon Roman Catholicism? It's one of the worst holiday of all, Easter. Now, if that doesn't make you upset, but it is. It's absolutely, you know, you got the bunnies with the eggs. Jesus is back. Quit. Hide the eggs. It's a mess. It's one of the most messed up, goofed up things. I loved it when we used to take a break on Easter. Because I loved it when people would say, well, but you're going to have big Easter service. Nope, we're closed. You're closed of all days on Easter? Well, yeah, why? My apostle teaches me, God's word teaches me, I'm not to take one day and I don't have to observe any of those days. It was always a lot of fun. But now I guess we're going to, you know, we do things a little bit differently here. But my point in all of this is just to once again bring up the issue that you have, again, this issue of following the wisdom of men. Ashes on the forehead, that's not the wisdom of God. My father didn't teach me that. Men taught me that. The reason you do what you do you do it because your father taught you that or because the wisdom of this world? A son thinks sober. That doesn't mean that you walk around with a frown on your face and you're all downcast all the time. I'm sober. And I like it. No, that's sober thinking means you're not under the influence. You're not under the influence of the wisdom of men, the wisdom of this world, the course of this world. You only have ears for your father. This was the issue of them coming along. Their inner man is in turmoil. They come to verse 22, and when they come to verse 22, a statement is made that they are that sobers them up, and they return. They finally remember something that they had already been taught. That's why verse 22 in Psalm 44 begins with the word "yay." And that's why the quote is from here in Romans 8:36, because the truth of the matter is this is the very same kind of thinking, the same kind of thing that will happen to us in this dispensation of grace in which we live, when we as sons deal with one who wants to separate us from the love of Christ, when we deal with the tactics of that adversary that wants to do that. And when that happens, we're being taught something in advance. Romans, I know this sounds really elementary, but you've got to sometimes come back to that. Romans 8, 28 through 39 occurs before Romans 12, 12. And that's why when you get to Romans 12, 12, you've only got three words: rejoicing in hope. That's what now is to be your thinking, your godly thinking. And when it comes to the conduct and behavior, you've got only three words: patient in tribulation. That's because you were taught something in advance. The real details of it was all taught back there in Romans 8, 28 through 39. And yet when those things start happening, when they actually become real, and they can have such an overwhelming effect upon us that we will resort to the thing that 'll kill us spiritually, rationalization. And we'll that's what these guys were doing. If you pay attention to what they're doing in the 44th Psalm, they're rationalizing. Well, if we had done this, you should be treating us this way. If we had done that, but we didn't do that. We didn't. What did we do? And this is exactly describing the world of Christianity today. Something bad happens. What did I do? What did I do? That's the way most of the Christians around me act. I don't know what I did. It had to be something. I did something bad. And God is punishing me for it. And then it's really funny when something good happens. What did I do? How would you like it if you had a business, a multi-billion-dollar business, and the one that you've got to run it, when something good or bad happens, the thing that comes out of his mouth is, what did I do? I'd fire that guy. I don't watch his show, but it'd be like Trump. You're fired. What did I do? You're just a spiritual ping pong ball. You're just bouncing all over the place. I don't know what I did. Why is God mad at me? Why is he happy with me? I don't know. You know, maybe I prayed a lot. Maybe I didn't pray a lot. Maybe I did this. Maybe I didn't that. And this is the dilemma and the confusion that's out there today. And you have to return to sober thinking. And the fact of the matter is, when rationalization starts taking place, you can talk yourself into a state of confusion and a state of distress, and you can become distraught, and we'll start expressing that with one word. Why? Usually it's whined. Why? And when you're at that point, when you panic, one guy, he defined panic. I can't remember who it was, but it was a great definition. Panic is what happens when you run out of information. And that's not bad. You know, as long as you still got something to operate on, it's, now what? You run out, you know, you're baking a cake, you run to the last ingredient, and then all of a sudden the back of the page is gone. I don't know what else to put in. Now panic sets in. That's on a mild state. But what happens is the inability to bring back into the mind what needs to be there, and you start complaining and confusion sets in. That's why Romans 8:36 starts off saying that, as it does, as it is written, not for it is written. And that's why verse 36 back there, you don't need to be flipping back and forth, but that functions as a bridge between that great nay and all these things of verse 37, we are more than conquerors. The bridge, if you want to be a more than conqueror, I love it how people want that verse. More than conqueror. Oh, I love that. It just rolls off the tongue and you can have a real preaching service out of that verse. Well, to get to that verse, you have to cross the bridge of verse 36. As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. That's the bridge to, in all these things, we're more than conquerors. That you want to talk about. When verse 35 is doing its job, and your honest, thoughtful consideration of all the scope that you would go through, tribulation-wise and distress-wise and persecution-wise and so forth, of those separation tactics from the one who wants to separate you from the love of Christ at all cost. When that thing goes in there, and when that probing question of that fifth probing question of Romans 8:35 probes your heart, it puts you in the state of Psalm 44. It puts you in the state of thinking about things and responding to things in a concept type way, that your heart is probed to the kind of potential problems that they can cause so that the kind of intimidation is felt by you. You almost feel the effects of that intimidation, and that all those things can have, and the distress and the fear-producing things that can go on throughout the balance of your sonship life as you qualify to come under those things. You don't qualify right now for peril or the sword, but you do qualify for tribulation, for trouble, just general trouble that can come your way. And that's much like the situation you find these members of the remnant in here in the 44th Psalm when they're in their fifth installment of the fifth course of punishment. A similar type of confusion and distressful thinking and distraught mindset develops in them, and it can develop in us. And just like they will have to face all that and have to sober up and operate on something they're taught, God isn't going to come along, and nation-wise anyway, He's not going to come along and stay the ill effects of it from the nation. They're going to have to go through that. They're going to have to endure that. But they are going to have something to operate on. Well, it's the same with us, and we need to learn that now so that we can expect that, and when the time comes, we can recall it and bring it to the surface. And we're not, when anything else would cause us to be confused, anything but that, if it wasn't for that, would cause us to cry out when we're actually experiencing those things. So our Heavenly Father is telling us in advance, He's preparing us in advance for what we're going to face resistance-wise and opposition-wise from the satanic policy of evil when we finally have gotten our sonship education underway. And this is where we have, of course, now in the fourth of the six components to our wisdom. Well, let's once again make sure that we focus in upon the one thing, because that's what your heart is looking for. That's what your soul is now crying out for. Give me one thing to latch onto, and that's the sober realization that makes all that excessive thinking, that soulish, drunken, and I mean when you get into inner man crippling effects, when your mind starts being affected, you can get into real, call it soulish drunkenness, where you're thinking really debauchery type mind blitzing thoughts that you just want. This is so unpleasant and it's so distressful and it's so stressful that I just want out of this. That's one of the reasons I went over there to show you Timothy, who had experienced all of that, and what Paul did to get Timothy's mind back, because Timothy's mind was to the point of breaking. And when Paul says, I've committed something unto him against that day, that evil day, I've committed my sanity to my Father. Well, when that kind of thing goes on, when fear and intimidation and distress take place, that makes it so that your heart, you don't want to eat, you don't want to get out of bed, you don't want to dress, you don't want to do anything until this one thing has to be addressed. And I'm looking for just this one thing that can sober the mind up and can bring relief. As you go down through the 44th Psalm, that's exactly what the members of the remnant of Israel come to in verse 22. And folks, they're experiencing it on levels that you and I today would, it's even hardly registerable for us. But for them, they're going to be in some really bad positions. Well, all that goes on prior to that, really from verse 9 down through verse 21, gives you a look in their heart. You get to look right into their soul and the machinations rationalizing the human heart can go through in a situation like that. Then they're brought back to sobriety. And then you, with that word, yea, of verse 22, it hits them, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Folks, the three words that you should latch onto that bring relief to your heart is for thy sake. And knowing intelligently what those three words mean. For thy sake. we are killed all the day long. They're brought back into thinking that there's something beneficial. For thy sake tells you there's something beneficial in this for us. Not just logically, but that the Father has allowed this to happen because this is part of our conformity to the image of His Son. We're going to be going through these things because He went through these things. We were told in Romans 8 earlier on that Jesus Himself suffers even in this dispensation of grace. Not physical suffering like we went through on the cross or anything along those lines, but He suffers through this dispensation as well. Our Father suffers through this time, and it is for thy sake. And therefore, we're going to do these things because this is all a part of the whole Father to Son sonship package deal. And again, the critical key issue in the godly remedy is that issue of for thy sake. And even though that's a logical conclusion, I grant you that, it can't be just appreciated logically. It has to be appreciated not for just that, but from the standpoint of you coming along as a son saying, that whole thing, along with the bad and the good, my sonship life and the living of it out, I just told my Father I loved that in the first place. That's my love. The love of my life. The love of Christ. And you're supposed to realize that going through the separation tactics of the policy of evil are all part and parcel of that sonship status. There's two sides to that coin. On the one side is the glorious aspects of as you go through the curriculum, having your Father's heart imparted to yours. And your heart and His become one. You think like He thinks and live like He lives and labors like He does with Him. But on the other side of that coin, you have a determined, avowed adversary is going to try to do everything he can to thwart that process because he desperately wants to try to hold the last venue that he's got at his disposal, which is the heavenly places. And what you're going to be able to do is to come along and you're going to be able to take the information your Father gives you and you're going to operate upon that. And that's going to take the stress off, the relief off, because three words have made it so that those three very powerful words bring the relief to that the soul has been looking for. And you're supposed to realize that the other side of this coin is knowing that the adversary's there, knowing that he has designed things and has things at his disposal, knowing that as I increase in my own Christian life and in my own sonship life, as I increase, the adversary qualifies to apply more and more pressure, more and more of its tactics against what I'm doing, to try to stop it, to try to thwart it. So he has to qualify for that. And that's one of the reasons you start out in Romans 12:12 with tribulation. You don't start out rejoicing in hope, patient in peril. He doesn't say that because you're not even to the point of that yet, but you're patient in tribulation. Well, the sobriety of your thinking comes along with those words, for thy sake. And again, this is something we have to pay a little bit of attention to here, and I don't know how much we're going to be able to actually finish all of this today. I was hoping we would, but let's just take a look at that and keep in mind that what we're after here are things that work out to my benefit. And the curriculum my Father puts in my hands, those letters of the Apostle Paul especially, then your sonship education is all going to work in accordance with the separation tactics, the policy of evil, but they're going to work with them to your benefit. They benefit you. Paul actually expresses that over in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. He expresses that several times. We don't have time to go look at a lot of passages, but we did when we first went over this. But that's keeping everything in the context here. And especially what we were looking at in Romans 8, keeping in context, because it's talking, going back to Romans 8, 28, 29, and 30. Well, once again, you kind of have to go through the virtual reality of putting yourself into a position where you feel the fear and the loathing and the kind of separation tactics that are applied against you, where this soulish response comes in. But your father is coming along and he's providing the only thing that you can get to bring relief and peace and rest back into your soul when your spirit and soul go at one another. And your soul comes along and basically your soul is just simply screaming at your spirit, I don't like these. I don't like this at all. I don't like this distress. I don't like this situation. And really what when you think about tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword, man, those things make your skin crawl. And they should make your skin crawl to think about going through things like that. And that's the stuff that starts going through your mind and making you shrink back at the persecution. Feel the effects of famine and nakedness, of peril, of even having to die for the cause of your sonship life. Well, it's your soul that's going to come along and rear its head, no matter what your spirit says. It's going to come along and resist that and say, no, 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 I don't want to do any of this. I'm going through all of that in just a mild form of it, of what we went through last time, to really put you in the position where you feel that in the pit of your soul, in the pit of your heart, where you do feel that fear, and where when you start rationalizing through it, you actually are coming along more or less and saying something to yourself where the reason I want out of this, the reason I want this to stop, really boils down to the issue of your own skin. You're saving your own hide out of the situation. Well, that's the kind of misery that you're put in through that when the dawn breaks at verse 36 and says, as it is written, not for it is written, but as it is written, there's a parallel that sets out there in that 42nd Psalm, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. And that's the attitude of a son. That's the attitude of a son that's been established properly. And that's one of the first issues that makes that more than conqueror the reality. Well, let's in the last moments that we have here talk just a little bit about this issue of for thy sake. Those three little words, I don't have this on the board, but those three little words comprise what your mind, what your human spirit is supposed to immediately latch onto when you first read there in verse 36, for thy sake. Or here in verse 22 of the 44th Psalm, yea, for thy sake. That's the one thing your soul's after. That's the one thing your spirit wants to bring relief and quell the fear, to bring sober thinking back. Now, when you think of that issue, for thy sake, you read that and you probably think, well, those are three very simple words. But you have to ask the question, why is that the first thing our heart's supposed to latch on to? And when it's in the why of this that you get the relief. Why does it bring relief? Why does that bring sober thinking back into our mind and begin to remedy us being successfully separated from the love of Christ? Well, first of all, I want to dismiss one idea. Let's dismiss the idea that the 44th Psalm passage, or the one over in Romans 8:36, is being said in a sense that it's all your fault, God, that I'm going through this mess. As if, well, it's all for your sake. That's not what for thy sake means anywhere or any place, but I just wanted to say that, I guess, for any goofballs, but that's not what this is saying. As if for thy sake means it's because of you, God, laying blame there. Israel did that all the time, by the way. They loved to do that, to blame God for it. We saw that in Romans 9, 10, and 11. In fact, my understanding that it's not really saying, listen, it's not really coming along and saying, it's for you, God, that I'm enduring all these things. How do I know it's not saying, it's for you, God, that I'm enduring all these things? How do I know that that's not what that says? This is, by the way, a trick question. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Or you could say it this way, because that's not what it says. You ever watch Jeopardy when they have stupid answers? That was a stupid question, but it had a stupid answer. But it's profound anyway. It doesn't say it's because of you. It says for thy sake. If they wanted to say it's because of you, they would have said it. The translators had all those words available. So it's not really coming along and saying, it's for you, God, that I'm enduring all these things, as if the emphasis, when he says, for thy sake, is being laid strictly and solely upon God. That's what all the other religions of the world have. That's what Islam has. The world of Islam will do some of the horrific things that they do because, in their mind, they're doing it, of course, for God. I'm doing this for Allah. I'm doing this for God. It's for you, God, that I'm blowing myself up along with a bunch of innocent people. It's for you, God. That's weak. That won't work. That won't sustain tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril. That won't sustain you through all of that. If that's all you've got is, I'm just doing this for Jesus, doing great things for Jesus, for thy sake, as if it's just for you. That leaves you with this kind of Calvinistic idea of, well, if it's God's will that I suffer, then I'm supposed to suffer. But it doesn't say, for you, O God. It doesn't say anything like that. But while those three words are important, I want to zero in on one of them. And that's that little word, sake. S-A-K-E. Sake. What does the word sake mean? Well, some of you probably know if you've read ahead or studied a little bit, but definition-wise, the word sake means a final cause, an end, a purpose, or rather the purpose of obtaining something. Sake actually has a whole bunch of meanings. It can be used a lot of ways. For instance, sake can mean to account or regard. But there's an important reason why God didn't have either the psalmist or Paul say, for thy account, which grammatically isn't exactly correct. Grammatically, you would have to change the word for to on to be proper, on your account. There's an important reason why he didn't say, for thy cause. That wouldn't have worked. That has a problem. For thy sake, though, that doesn't. That's the answer. For thy cause, even though cause is a lot closer than account, on your account, for thy cause is a lot closer. It's very close to the for thy sake. Sake would probably be the very most excellent word. Cause might be the second most excellent word. But sake is the most excellent choice of words used in our English language here, because the word sake, and you're probably aware of this, what I'm about to say, carries a shade of meaning that cause or account or any other word like that doesn't carry. And I'm going to take you to a chart that we used when we went through this, and we'll just go through this very briefly, and this will have to do it for today. And we're going to work through this. This comes from Smith's Synonyms, Discriminated, from 1822. And what he has to say here is bang on when it comes to the excellency of the choice of words here. And it's critical. Because when you're hurting like they're hurting there, you want the right antidote. You don't want somebody giving you an aspirin when you're suffering, when you need morphine. So you need to have accuracy. And there's accuracy in your King James Bible, far more than most people ever realize. The word sake, as Smith says here, and I'll point some things out, and there's some additional things I've got here. He says, in discussing the discriminating difference or shade of meaning between sake and account, notice on the board at the very top, both sake and account can be employed both of persons and of things. Both of persons and of things. And to be grammatically correct, we say for the sake and on account. But sake. And this is what I have right here in, on this kind of ugly, kind of, well, it's kind of ugly on my screen, bluish teal looking color. Sake denotes an ulterior purpose which is contemplated. For thy sake, there's an ulterior purpose. Ulterior meaning it's lying beyond what is evident or realized. There's something beyond the suffering that is revealed or realized or evident beyond the area of immediate interest. Coming down here, the word account, if you use the word account, it denotes an anterior cause or motive which induces action, anterior meaning placed before or in front of. Moreover, now I'm down here, moreover, account is no more than a cause, but sake is a cause in which, listen, one is directly and personally concerned. When you say it's for thy sake, now you're talking about I as a son, I'm directly and personally concerned with this. It's not just simply this is being done for you, but there's two ways. This is a two-way street. Sake makes it both ways. Sake means what I'm going through is for God my Heavenly Father's sake, but I have a vested personal interest as well. Both of us are in view. If you just use the word account, you've just got one in view. But when you use the word sake, you've got your Father in view and you in view. You're personally and directly concerned with it. If I say I'm doing this for His sake, I mean that I'm doing it because I have an end in view which I believe to be in His interest, that I should accomplish it, and in my interest in it because I'm personally concerned with it. If I say I'm doing it on His account, I mean broadly and simply that He's in some way the cause of my doing it. So then, by the excellency of the choice of simple words like sake, for thy sake, we're to understand and appreciate this isn't just to be done for God, as it's simply being God's will, but rather as sons are having the attitude of being killed, as it says, all the day long and counted as sheep for the slaughter. That's all for my Father's sake. It has a purpose that lies beyond its obvious area of immediate interest. And for you as a son, you know what that is. What is the purpose beyond just enduring it? What? Being conformed to the image of Christ. That's good and right. Is there another purpose beyond the immediate? To what? Right. The glory that comes of the joint heir and being placed in the creature. Another way of saying that, training, being trained. It has, being more than a conqueror in it, means that there is benefit for me to be trained, to be skilled, to gain skill sets and acquire skill sets that's going to make it so that I can function to my Father's honor and glory in the heavenly places, in the creature. And so, sake is a powerfully yet simple word, powerful but simple word. And it has purpose that lies beyond the obvious area of immediate interest. It points out something to which not just one party is going to benefit from and to be in God's best interest, but it points to something that I as His son will have a vested interest and benefit in myself as His son. That's the way this relationship started out. Like father, like son. The father comes along and says, I'm doing this, we're doing this together. You're not my child. I'm not going to dress you. I'm not going to clothe you. I'm not going to feed you. I'm not going to do all of these things, make all these choices for you. We're both adults here. And as two adults, we're going to function that way. And my business has enormous benefit for you as my son. But it also has great benefit for me to have you as my son. That little word is just incredible in what it's able to convey. For thy sake, we are all this. It's for my Father's sake and for the sake of my sonship life that I'm killed all the day long and counted as sheep for the slaughter. back in the time of our first war of independence, what's commonly called the American Revolution, a lot of suffering went on in our troops. There was a time in the winter of 1777-1778 at a place called Valley Forge where our troops, when they bivouacked there, you could follow their trail through the blood of their feet in the snow. And it was a very tough time. And those militias, those were farmers, merchant owners, store owners. Those weren't, by and large, trained military. And they suffered through an agonizing winter. And General Washington showed up there with great presence of mind to know what his presence would do for them. And what he had been able to demonstrate, at least to some measure, was that they could hope in him. But as he was there, he'd pass by and they would say such things as they were enduring this. It's recorded in history that they would actually say, "It's for your sake, General, that we're enduring all this." They use the word sake. In other words, it was like saying, "It's for the cause of liberty." And that cuts both ways. That has benefit for you, General, and it's got benefit for me. That I'm going to endure this war to its bitter end. Both would benefit from it. And that's exactly the way your father designed this. The suffering that you and him endure. You are not told as a son that you endure this alone. He says, "I suffer it with you, and we have labor in it." But we can take the worst our adversary can throw at us, the absolute worst. And in a sense, your father pretty much does that to the adversary as you go through your sonship life. Basically, he turns to him and says, "There's my son. Go do your worst. Go ahead, do your bitter worst and watch what he can do." You saw this in the life of Jesus Christ himself. When the adversary tried his absolute dead best to thwart him in his life. And your father says, "Watch how my son, based upon the effectual working of my word," what I just described there could be boiled down to one word, grace. Watch what grace can do to every dart you throw at him. How it can be turned around and worked for his advantage. And what I just described there was Romans 8:28. If it weren't for Romans 8:28, what we would be doing would be legalistic works based on our own human good and own human effort. But Romans 8:28 forbids that. Because Romans 8:28 says the work that you do and what you're going to do as a son is combined with my words effectual working in your inner man. So we have that very powerful expression, "for thy sake." That is a matter that comes into your soul and it begins settling your soul. Once your inner man has been put through the virtual reality of undergoing those seven separation tactics from the satanic policy of evil, and your soul is crying out for something it can latch on to, that will not only bring relief from the turmoil, but that more than that will be something it can operate upon while enduring these things. It's as it is written. That parallel issue from the 44th Psalm gets brought into our thinking. And then we hit those three magnificent words, "for thy sake." And that begins doing some things in our thinking. Providing us information for our human spirit to give our soul calm, to bring relief, to bring rest to it. Bring us back to sober thinking, godly thinking about being in tribulation, patient in it. And being in circumstances that are like that, and not just having God's powerful hand go zoop and sweep them away. And for one of the first thoughts your mind begins to process that for thy sake issue. And one of the first things that you get in your thinking is that this is a cause in which my father is directly concerned. He's in this. He's personally and directly concerned with it. and one in which I, as his son, we have something in common together in this that we're vested in and directly and personally concerned with. That's mutual concern. That's mutual. It's mutual success in our sonship life and living it out, even under the effects of the our mutual enemy. Satan isn't just your enemy. The only reason you even come up on his radar is because you're associated with your Father through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. The only reason you even come to his attention is because you're being conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. You're not being conformed to the image of Confucius or the image of Muhammad, the prophet Muhammad, who never prophesied anything. You're not being conformed into the image of a president or L. Ron Hubbard. That matters nothing to the adversary. It's being conformed into the image of Christ. And you and your Father share not just mutual aims, goals, and objectives in your sonship life. You and your Father share a mutual enemy. So you never go through it just without him. He's always involved in it himself. And he's involved in it to the tune of every jot and tittle of every word that he has written to you to do its effectual job, to make it so that, you come out of the end of that as more than a conqueror. That doesn't mean you just endured it and you just conquered it, but that it worked to your and his mutual benefit. And the thing your heart grabs a hold of, like a magnet grabs a hold of steel, is for thy sake. These things are happening, and you have an intelligent understanding of what that means. And by the way, I don't really think you can have that kind, or I'll tell you right now, you will not have that level of understanding in what we just went over. Because I've skipped a bunch of stuff that we taught the first time around. That's where that should have been taught. I'm just reminding you of something. I'm not reteaching anything. So don't kid yourself into thinking, well, I got it now that in just what I've taught in the last several Bible classes, because I'm teaching the core of this assembly that had this in detail the first time we went over it, so that all I'd have to do now is remind you of it. Well, we're out of time really for today, but I'm going to look over and see if there's any other additional issues that we want to bring up here. We didn't go over the issue yet of, I might want to talk a little bit about him, why he uses the phrase, we are killed all the day long, what that's supposed to mean, all the day long. He's not going to stop this. There's not going to be any cessation to it. So therefore, once you actually go into the issue of, we'll put it back up here with this one. When these things actually begin to take place, tribulation, when that starts, these are all going to start happening. And like I said, it may be because of the nation we live in and the time frame that we live in, that maybe none of us will ever get out there to the point of peril or sword or those kinds of things. But we're all going to experience some, if not most, of what's in this list. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so that's just going to be ratcheting up as you start growing in your sonship life. That's also going to grow with you. But your Father, if it weren't for your Father and your Father's words effectually doing their job, this would destroy you. And he did far more than just make it so that you'd endure it and survive it. He made it so that if the adversary didn't do those things, you wouldn't progress as fast as you would normally. That's being more than a conqueror. Well, I think we'll leave it right there for now, and I'll just kind of think about what we want to do to tie some loose ends up there in verse 22, or back there in Romans 8 and verse 36, in the godly remedy, when we are killed all the day long, we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. And with that kind of remedy that is supposed to be operating in the soul, then you can come along and say, nay, in all these things, we are more than conquerors. And you can come back to then dealing properly and adequately with this hope doctrine, where we are told that we are to rejoice in hope. We have a love-based convincement that has produced that hope doctrine, based upon the effectual working of Romans 8, 28 through 39. And now's the time when we pull that out and put it into play, because we are going to have to be patient in tribulation and continue instant in prayer. And we will, should have that tied up within the next couple of Bible classes. And after all the background work has been said, the actual work in the verse isn't going to take much time at all. But you kind of have to pull a lot of things back into your thinking. Well, we'll stop right there, and then we'll pick it up then on Wednesday night, as we always do, and see if there's any questions or comments or anything that you have at that time. All right, with our heads back.